You're listening to episode 2 of the Ecology Podcast. I'm your host, Arundhai Nandan, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Charles Plaisir and Kyle Grant. This week, we're talking about what ecology is, the debate between peer and applied research in ecology, and the biases which exist in funding science. This week, we're going to be talking about what ecology is. Ecology is the scientific study of the relationships between the processes behind an organism's ability to survive, grow, and reproduce, as well as the physical and chemical components that make up that environment, so abiotic components such as temperature, moisture, oxygen concentration, and light availability, and the biological and living components, so the biotic components of these environments. The systems in which these interactions occur is known as an ecosystem. The term eco actually comes from the Greek root word oikos, which means family, household, and modern day ecology has strong roots in the plant geography and natural history movements of the 1800s. Patterns in ecological systems are what are studied by ecologists at many different spatial and temporal scales, so from the individual organism all the way up to the entire planet's systems, and each level leads to a different set of questions and approaches for study. So starting at the smallest scale at which ecologists study, we have individual organisms, and we look at these from the basis of their morphology or their structure, physiology, and their behavior, and how these influence their ability to survive, grow, and reproduce. From there, we have population and population ecology, population ecologists study shifts in the number of individuals in a population being a group of individuals of the same species that occupy a given area. And population ecologists look at how these numbers change in time and space due to factors such as birth, death, immigration, and emigration. Populations of different species living and interacting within an ecosystem are referred to as a community, and community ecologists study the factors that influence numbers and types of species in a given area. Ecosystem ecologists study how abiotic and biotic processes interact within a system and focus on the flow of energy and nutrients within or through, rather, both systems. And these communities and ecosystems exist in a patchwork across a larger landscape. And so landscape ecologists study the factors that lead to the way a landscape looks, as well as the consequences that this has on spatial patterns, of these spatial patterns on the dispersal of organisms, the exchange of energy and nutrients between adjacent ecosystems, and the propagation of disturbances such as fire and disease between ecosystems. Now, moving up from communities, we have the level of the biome. And biomes are regions that are dominated by a similar type of ecosystem. So, for example, tropical rainforests and deserts. And ecologists at this level study patterns of species between the different biomes, and they ask questions such as why some regions of the world are able to support more species than others. Now, the final scale at which ecologists study at is the level of the biosphere. All ecosystems, both land and water-based, are linked through exchanges in materials and energy. And ecologists at this level study the patterns in this energy, as well as nutrient transfer between different ecosystems and other Earth systems, such as atmosphere, the hydrosphere, and the geosphere. All ecological studies tend to follow the scientific method, they do follow the scientific method, and that is they start with an observation which leads to asking specific testable questions known as hypotheses. These hypotheses are tested through experiments done in the field, in situ, in the lab, in vitro, or even in a computer, so in silico. The results of these experiments, which is a snapshot in time and space known as a data set, are used to create simplified representations of the system, and these are known as models, which can then be used to make future predictions. There's a trade-off as to the type of research that is undertaken. So for example, field research tends to have a lot of outside influences on an experiment that cannot be controlled, but they're normally more easily applied to a real-world setting as opposed to a lab or a computer-based work, which are able to control for a lot more of these external influences, but cannot, because they can't take into account every interaction around us, they don't necessarily represent what occurs in the real world. As it deals with chemical, physical, and biological processes, ecology is an interdisciplinary science, And the application of ecology to environmental problems which threaten our survival as a species, so these include human population growth, biological diversity, sustainability, and global climate change, requires an ever-expanding framework that includes historical, social, legal, political, and ethical dimensions. We can imagine that moving forward, the field of ecology will embrace even more disciplines outside of our traditional view of the sciences. And just like the populations of the organisms that we study, the science is constantly evolving. So that's kind of a quick gist of what ecology is. And so this week, I selected a paper entitled Fundamental Ecology is Fundamental. So this paper is an opinion piece from 2015 by Frank Courchamp and his colleagues, and it was published in Trends in Ecology and Evolution. So just a little bit of background as to what the paper is. So the paper speaks about fundamental or basic ecology. Basic ecology is the study of ecology motivated by the goal of advancing knowledge and understanding without a fixed objective, and in order to develop and test general theories in the field of ecology. Now, this is contrasted with applied ecology, which is motivated by well-defined objectives, such as solving environmental problems, as well as managing resources. And currently, scientists believe that there is a decrease in the funding towards these basic ecology or basic ecological sciences, and that there's been an increase in funding towards applied ecology. And the authors say that this is due to the way that we actually fund science. In the past, science was a pastime of the wealthy who had a lot of time on their hands, and so they either were scientists themselves or they paid others to do so, to engage in science. And science also used to be funded by the public by showcasing the results of exhibitions, or rather their results in exhibitions and expositions. Now, after the Industrial Revolution, funding became a lot more centralized towards larger institutions such as universities, the government, and private organizations. And the authors say that this has actually resulted with the focus being shifted more towards benefiting the funders for their objectives rather than science just for the sake of the science or the sake of exploration. Another issue the authors state that's leading to a lack of funding for basic ecology is that as governments have become larger stakeholders in scientific research, the funding timescales have become shorter in correlation with the shorter lengths of the political mandates. And furthermore, a lack of transparency as to what the benefits of basic ecology has to the general public has also led to taxpayers openly objecting to research that isn't directly applied. In addition, the misrepresentation of ecology as being the same as environmentalism has led to the further confusion of the role of ecology, environmentalism being primarily an activism-based based approach or field. Now, the authors then state that the benefits of basic research, in this paper, they go on to state the benefits of basic research and how applied research actually relies upon this basic research to make breakthroughs. They argue that breakthroughs are often resultant from a combination of curiosity, creativity, intelligence, passion, perseverance, and chance, and that exploring the wonders of life and the nature of things for the sake of knowledge alone is one of the most ancient and noble of human aspirations. They say that it's actually quite rare to have new applications from applied research, since innovation tends to stem from translations or recombination of existing knowledge. And some of the examples of this include using predator-prey dynamics in the industrial and political economics, looking at ecosystem stability and complexity research being used in the regulation of our banks, and behavioral ecology of social insects being used in robotics. They also state that since we can't anticipate all of the biological and environmental challenges that we as a species will face in the future, it's important to have a fundamental understanding of the problems at hand if we are to find the best path to solve them. So other benefits also include apart from just the overall increase in the body of knowledge, is the training of graduate students and other researchers, the creation of new scientific instruments and methods, and the development of networks for social interactions, as well as the enhancement of problem-solving capacities, the creation of new firms, and the provision of social knowledge. Finally, the authors provided a number of steps that ecologists could be taking to promote basic science, such as assessing the state of progress made in fundamental or basic ecology by publishing more articles, developing and using new approaches to communicate the results to politicians and grant funding agencies, creating programs for promising or experienced researchers specifically targeted to funding these type of projects, Establishing norms for funding that agencies can use, developing ways to quantify the values of basic research, reducing the pressure on ecologists to constantly be publishing their short-term results, often at the expense of their long-term research priorities. Encouraging students to conduct side projects and pilot projects that are kind of fundamental in nature, as well as prioritizing the defense of basic research as a community of ecologists. So there's a few things that I do want to discuss. I'll just mention really quickly some of the things that I enjoyed about the paper, as well as some of the things that I didn't quite enjoy in the paper. So a few things I found that were pretty good were that it did paint a good picture as to what fundamental ecology is like, you know, that mix of creativity and perseverance, which I think people sometimes forget is a part of science. I found that there was a good link from ecology of the past, which was run by aristocrats, to kind of the science of today, which is more politically driven. It's also good that they mentioned that the common confusion between what ecology and environmentalism is. I'm sure you guys have encountered that problem speaking to others when they ask you, what do you do? And the first kind of thought is, oh yeah, so you must be out on the streets picketing, right? That's what your degree is. And I'm sure there's some ecologists that do cross over between the two, but they're very, very, very different. So some of the things I disliked about the paper was that it does gloss over the fact that I believe many researchers do basic research. It might not be written as such in the grants, but side projects are really common amongst researchers, simply because, when you do applied research and you apply for the funding, that money is used to actually create something that whoever is funding you is going to use, and then the extra money or rather on the side, you can use that to do some of these more fundamental research goals. If that passion project on the side ends up making money and leads to something bigger, that's awesome, but not all passion projects do. And this is not, I think, limited to just ecology. I think that can be said for music and literature. You might be an author and, you're writing the next great novel, but to pay the bills, you have to start writing copy for marketing purposes for, I don't know, an oil company or something. I'm also skeptical of their statement that innovation doesn't come from applied research as much as it does from basic research, because, I can't see why applied research would be any less likely to be combining and remixing previous work into something. There's also a lot of incidental research and findings that comes out from that pursuit of applied goals. And I think that can be, classified as fundamental research in its own right. And lastly, I found that they didn't really list any of the benefits, or rather the benefits they listed weren't exclusive to basic ecology. I don't see why applied research can increase knowledge and supply new researchers and develop new techniques and the networks and train graduate students or any of these other benefits they listed. So overall, while I think it's important to discuss this topic, as a philosophical question, I don't know if ultimately science is any different than any other career path that's affected by the economy, like literature or music, as I mentioned earlier. And oftentimes scientists and engineers and doctors and a lot of other professions or professionals, they might fall into the trap of thinking that their vocation is somehow purer or better than the other. But ultimately, we're judged by a market and through our reputation, and both are, in the end, it comes down to money. And that money comes from the certainty and quality of the service that we provide to society. So I kind of get what the authors are saying. Peer research is great, and to go brazenly into the unknown to discover the secrets of the universe and all that kind of very almost esoteric thoughts. I think it's great, but at the same time, we have to stay grounded, especially when we have problems, right here, right now, that need solving. Because I don't know how many people, who don't have access to clean drinking water are really going to be caring about the underlying processes behind eco-evolutionary dynamics. So I'm kind of curious. Yeah, I don't know. I'm curious what you guys thought about the paper. If you kind of agree with some of the things I mentioned, or if you heartily disagree with anything that I've said, anything that I found out about, or what I thought about the paper. So I don't know if maybe actually Charlie, do you want to start this
one? Yeah, for sure. I'll start. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you on the fact that this paper is very interesting and that it brings us back to the basic of the fundamental research, why we started studying the processes in nature and why are they so important for us to understand what world we live in and how to interact with our environment. And I do, of course, agree with you regarding what you did not like about the article, because it's written by someone who's all for basic research. And I see that, I feel like they're differentiating the three different types of research a bit too much, in my opinion, because every research will have a fundamental, an applied, and a possibly a development aspect of it. And as researchers or future researchers, we are aware of that. When we have to propose a project, we have to write for a grant, we need all these sections to be covered in our articles or in our proposals, because that's how you get your funding from. You cannot just request money to find something interesting without having it applied to something in the world today that we live in today. And let's say you are working on fish and how interesting it is to scare fish as an example, but there's always going to be a future direction. It might be, it will not, it's not right now, it's not right here, but you can definitely expect in the next few decades, the next few years, with climate change, with the different changes we have in the environment, that this research will be applied to some extent. So I find that the author differentiates a bit too much of these three categories, but I don't think they're so different. And I think the funding should benefit all three categories, but as a whole, they should all be included in the same sort of group as it is right now. I don't know. That's my opinion. You know, I don't think they're all that different.
Yeah, they're certainly not discrete categories, right? So I was thinking, Arun, while you were giving the intro, don't you think the sheer quantity of research that's out there is way larger now? So to say that we're shifting from pure to applied, well, maybe it's just that there's more research being done. So, you know, in total, there's still more pure research being done now than there has been in the past, right?
Yeah, there must be. I mean, the cost of research, I imagine, has gotten cheaper since you know, back when Darwin, you know, was, you know, hopping aboard the Beagle. He wasn't the scientist, right? He was the ship captain's, what was it? His, like, not assistant, but his companion. I mean, how much would it have cost at that point had he not been from a wealthy family to do research? And I imagine as you said, I mean, the sheer quantity of research that's out there nowadays. I mean, do you think maybe it's due to kind of the democratization of science?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm getting at. It's essentially, you know, I see this as a good thing that there's so much applied research being done right now. It means that, like, there's been a big focus on, you know, hey, we need to fund these things, so there is application for this stuff.
And I also think that's how we're going to get more funding for the fundamental aspect of research, because if we don't ever apply it and we only focus on the basic research aspect, then what is the point of what we're doing besides curiosity? I think this curiosity could be used for humans to develop in their changing world. Like, again, applied science is not that far off fundamental research, because we have to develop the pertinence of our project. The reason why we're doing this project is because we want to be able to apply it in nature and see if there can be a difference. And in this time, day and age, with climate change, with all the changes we are able to see in the world, we will have to keep doing fundamental research and understand how everything is changing in the environment, and we'll have to act upon it. So again, I think that there's more research nowadays. It's more accessible. It is definitely more democratized, but I think it's a good thing in that sense. And if we want to increase the funding towards fundamental biology, it's by making it profitable for everyone in society, which is, I think, what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. I certainly agree with the idea that, you know, to kind of answer or respond to these changes, you know, especially these global crises as we move forward, we need, I mean, I guess essentially more hands on deck, and in this sense, it's, you know, more scientists that are able to work. So Do you think the, well, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, do you think citizen science kind of fits into this paradigm? Do you think citizen science ends up being more of a pure science or a fundamental form of research or an applied form of research?
I mean, certainly what I've seen of it, it seems more on the applied side. It's, you know, especially its use in conservation, right? I'm not sure how you would fit this into citizen science into pure science.
Well, I mean, there's certain, it was, I'm thinking of a one that was in the neurosciences. There's this kind of game that was created where the general public could go online and you had to map, you know, basically match colors in a picture, and you were engaging the public in it. Well, I guess, yeah, actually, I suppose that is applied, because the end result was that they were mapping a certain pathway that computers could not recognize, the pathway itself. But I'm just trying to think, if, you know, if the individual doesn't know, yeah, I suppose it doesn't make a difference then. If the individual knows.
I don't know if that would classify as citizen science. That sounds like it's just a cool way of collecting, I don't know, a good way of collecting data. Would this, like, how do you define citizen science then? Like, how would you kind of break the two up into categories?
I would say the interesting thing about citizen science is that you're mobilizing a group of people from different backgrounds to reach a common goal. And to reach a common goal, it's rarely going to be only about curiosity or only about something that you can write an article and publish. It's usually going to be about something you can act upon or you can show to some governing entities, and they will look at it and be like, oh, this is really interesting. Let's move and do something about it. So I think that citizen science is closer to the applied side in that sense, that these kids or these adults that have jobs, that have their own occupations, to get out of their routine and participate in a biological experiment, they need to see an outcome close to them, you know, not something that will be maybe potentially interesting in a few years.
I suppose that's where my question lies. It's, you know, I mean, just as you mentioned, these adults and these kids who, you know, presumably they have many other priorities and responsibilities and things to do in their lives. But, you know, out of their own free time, they're going and they're engaging in science in this manner. To me, it seems like similar to that kind of history of ecology where, you know, if you weren't asking a rich person to fund your trip across the world, you were showcasing your previous results to a group of people through an expo, and then they would, you know, pay, you know, through tickets essentially to witness what your findings were. And then from there, you know, that's where you would recoup some of your money, and that's when, you know, you would then build upon that and move forward, you know, with more research. But I'm wondering, you know, in that sense, is then citizen science just an extension of that? Is it a way to engage the public in research? Because presumably the persons that are, you know, mapping the brain or collecting you know, insects in a and identifying them in their schoolyard, I'd imagine they might not necessarily know what the end result of that research is for, but rather the selling point is, hey, like, do you want to go look at some bugs and bring them inside? At least that's been my experience with citizen science, and I'm not sure, you know, is it, you know, the data set itself might be used in an applied setting later on, but during the actual collection, do you think that it's then a, you know, from the perspective of the public that's engaging, do you think that then classifies as a peer or fundamental or basic research, or do you think that the public knows that it's for an applied purpose, and do you think that matters?
For me, it seems that it doesn't really matter. To me, it seems like these kind of initiatives, they seem to be kind of, like you said, geared more towards engagement and awareness, sort of as for education rather than actual data collection. But I mean, this is just based on my minimal experience, so maybe you've seen otherwise, but to me it seems like it's more a tool for engagement.
Of course, it depends. Every case is different. If I have experience in a citizen science project doing a bird count to see how many birds are left in this area of the city, as an example, it's, you know, the line is very thin between fundamental and applied, but I guess it could also depend on the project and your target audience, because as you're saying, Kyle, some projects will solely be for general interest of people, for to go outside, collect bugs in the swamp or something like that. And others will be because there's an actual issue in the city and you want the citizen to get engaged in that problem. So it's not as simple as citizen science is more fundamental than applied or vice versa. But yeah, I guess it would depend. It would depend on the type of project and the type of I mean, the goal that the researchers want to achieve from that community project as well.
So then do you guys think that there's really ever been a, you know, fundamental research? Has that, you know, have we ever as a community really been doing peer research, or has it always been applied and this idea is of, you know, basic science as being this holy grail of research is really just a myth that we've created as this, you know, pure form of science that doesn't really exist. Do you guys think that that's, do you think there really is or ever has been basic ecology?
I'd say there has been. I mean, if you think of Darwin, for example, does that have a direct applied use, or would you say that's just pure evolutionary biology? I think that's a good example. It's some of the older research, they weren't going out with a goal in mind. It was simply just to understand how the natural world works.
I'm very curious about the terms. There's a graph, figure one, in the article, and it shows basically a triangle with three different parts. 15% is about fundamental research, 27% for applied, and 50% for development. And again, it's saying also in small characters that fundamental research is curiosity driven, applied research is solution driven. And with that graph in mind, I would definitely say there has been basic fundamental research in the past, and there still is basic fundamental research to this day. And again, there's so many definitions for the term applied. Applied doesn't mean solution, doesn't mean future use for a situation that we might face in the future. I don't know. It's very, like, they describe it with the term solution. I do not completely agree with that, because lots of research will have a goal in mind without necessarily facing a problem. Just understanding something for future use, does it mean that there is a problem at the moment? I am not sure. I don't know if I'm being clear right now. But basically, yes, if the question is, has there ever been research done for curiosity to understand the world around us? I believe there has been, and there still is to this day. And I think most people in universities in North America, at least, are doing research based on curiosity. They have to include an applied, or not an applied, but applications side to their project. But most of these projects are based on the curiosity part of science. And I've heard and I've seen also in other places and other universities or other countries, it's a bit different. It's a bit more towards applied, or they have more of these applied programs that are emerging because they're facing conservation issues that are accepted by governmental bodies. But from the Western world, or from the North American side of the world, I have seen lots of universities with these fundamental, basic, curiosity-driven programs. So I think it still exists.
You actually, what you were saying just now, Charlie, kind of made me think of, the different spheres at which research is undertaken, especially in ecology. I mean, from the government to universities to, and as you mentioned, across countries, this varies. And I'm thinking, traditionally we're looking at, you know, research from an academic perspective, and I imagine maybe referring to this the chart you mentioned, or the figure that you mentioned, that in theory academic research should be mostly curiosity driven, and I imagine that private industry run research tends to be more solution driven, so it's very much applied in nature, and then there might be crossover with the engineering world, or even within the government, that might be more development and production driven. So ecological research for the sake of resource acquisition, for example, and extraction. But do you think, I guess first of all, do you guys think that applied research, fundamental research can be done or is done outside of the realm of academia? And then following on that, do you believe that from your experience, do you think that most of the research that's undertaken at the university level is in fact curiosity driven, or is the majority still applied driven? And it's kind of, as I mentioned earlier, is it more of a pet project, the of the faculty to run these more pure or basic forms of ecology?
I mean, in my opinion, in my experience, I've rarely or never seen fundamental research done by private industries, because they have limited timeframes, they have their own money that's on the line, and they want goals to be able to make money out of whatever situation they're paying for. And for universities, there will be applied science programs, more so now than before, I'm sure. But I feel I have that feeling that most universities will still have that old, I will call it old science or old style of research, which is a bit more curiosity driven, because the applied aspect of science seems like it's being more popularized now with the issues we're facing currently and with the difficulties of funding opportunities that we get. We need to get the applied aspect a bit more, a bit more than what it used to be. So I think so that there is a difference between the private and the university industry, in that there's more fundamental research happening within universities and more applied development research happening in the private industry.
Yeah, so I tend to agree with Charlie. Private industry, just in general, it's going to be goal-driven, right? So I don't think there's much room for fundamental research. And as far as at the university level, I think, you know, a big part of it is of this paper is suggesting that, you know, if we want to do fundamental research, it shouldn't just be considered a side project. There should be funding to do this as a main project as well. So I think that might be sort of part of the author's argument, that, you know, when we apply for grants or any kind of funding, it's there always has to be an applied aspect to your work, right? Mm-hmm. So if you just go out there and say, hey, I want to study this just because, you know, I want to know how it works, you're not going to get funding. So yes, there's room for fundamental research at universities, but I think that, like you said earlier, there has to always be some sort of applied focus on that work. So it's I guess the question would be, why can't we fund pure research? What's wrong with that? I mean, I know there is pure research that's occurring, but don't you guys think that maybe it is sort of a problem that if we do apply for a grant or we do need funding, that it almost always has to have some kind of applied focus to it? I mean, you're kind of limiting the scope of what we can look at in that way.
Well, I certainly agree with you that there is a limit on the scope that we can, you know, think about. And it also runs the risk of creating these well-worn trails where, you know, one person kind of forges away in this one application and now all of a sudden, you know, everybody's going that one direction because that's where the money is. And there might be, you know, looking at it from an applied side, there might be these solutions, you know, right at the next, you know, like 2 feet to the left, but we'll never see it because we're still on that one single trail that everybody's looking at. It actually reminds me of when I was working in the CSBN and I was doing research on apolipoprotein E as a kind of a factor related to Alzheimer's and late onset dementia. And for the longest time, so the idea of ApoE being involved in these processes came about in the early 90s or late 80s, I believe. And around the same time, the idea of prions and you know mad cow disease being the primary driver of Alzheimer's and late onset dementia, they both came about around the same time. And it just so happened that the lab that had put out this prion focused paper had more influence and more pull within the academic community and the research community than the APOE lab and their papers. And so for the better part of a decade, actually, maybe by almost two decades, all of the research was focusing on prions and tau proteins as being the driving force behind Alzheimer's. And everyone needs to be researching what's the causes of this and how do we stop this, how do we get rid of it. And you know, meanwhile, this one other lab was just, you know, they continued doing their APOE work. And then it was around 2010, but it was somewhere around at that time period, there was a Nature review, which actually then kind of said, oh, hey, by the way, there's this research on APOE, which is also promising. And that, you know, it lit a spark. Now everybody was looking at, wait, we haven't really seen much coming out of the, you know, the other side. Maybe we should all be looking at APOE. And there was this sudden flood. When at the whole time, you know, researchers could have been focusing on both equally, because there wasn't necessarily one wasn't necessarily better than the other in terms of an applied aspect. It just happened to be that there was more pull in one direction. In that case, you know, maybe more politically or through the community. But I'd imagine funding would also lead to a similar well-worn path. So I agree with you that could be an issue. However, do you think that's realistic? Do you think it's realistic to fund peer research? I mean, as you mentioned earlier, there's so much research out there. At what point, you know, do we say, okay, well, we have all this peer research. Maybe we should just be focusing on the applied stuff. Maybe we should just, you know, take a step back and say, okay, we've done all this work. Now, how can we actually use it?
Well, I mean, I would argue that at least from the paper that we're looking at today, it doesn't seem that peer research is as prolific as you're suggesting. It seems like there's still a lot of room for peer research to take place. So we focus so much, I mean, according to the authors, we focus so much on the applied aspect that we're kind of neglecting this other part that can give rise to all these new applied fields.
Now that funding opportunities come from governing bodies and we don't necessarily have the luxury to choose what we'll be doing research on because we're spending the public's money in some way, that is definitely limiting in the freedom we can have with the research we do. So that does not answer our question, but that does put a big, it's a big boundary, a big barrier to the freedom we can take, because we have to produce something. Since we're using the public's money, it has to be, we have to be held accountable for with the research we're doing and produce something within someone's lifetime, someone who's investing money in our research has to see results in a short time frame, unfortunately. I feel like that's what the problem is, unless we have that applied purpose or that applied component on a project.
All right, so it sounds like the problem is that we don't have enough, outreach to explain to people why peer research is important. So unless there's a direct applied benefit that can be taken from something, people don't see it as worthy of funding. So I guess the question is, how do we sort of explain to people that basic biology or basic ecology is just as important or as fundamental as applied side?
So imagine it's a matter of education, right? I mean, it's a value-based proposition that we're putting forth, that to convince the public that it's worth following up, it's worth doing. I mean, they need to actually value science as a field, and they need that understanding that there are benefits And I think, you know, the authors do mention this, that they need to, the benefit from peer research may not be immediately evident, but there needs to be kind of almost a trust that, okay, they're doing this thing, and right now it seems like this makes no sense except for like the, hey, this is really cool factor, but in the future, this might actually save lives, for example. So maybe it's education, or maybe we're already doing enough with education. I don't know what, if you guys have, how you guys feel about your early ecology education before coming to university.
Well, interesting that you say that, because let me call it blind trust that the public has for some research institutions is that what we would need essentially for them fundamental ecology. Looking at any research done for any sort of disease for humans, it is common that we will donate for different causes because we're like, donate for this disease research or that disease research. And it's easier because it's close to us. It's proximate. You see people in your families, in your schools, anywhere who have diseases, or their loved ones have diseases. And that only that can actually motivate someone to close their eyes and just trust and accept that it will take some time to find the solution or the cure to some diseases. And for the basic ecology, then it's a bit of a tougher issue where it's not as proximate. The problems with the environment, as an example, where we need to understand how the biological systems work, it's not as proximate. It's not as easy to observe and to assess and to understand they are here, they're happening right now. And that's the first thing. So when you're talking about outreach and education, I think it's very important for society to understand what is going wrong on the biological framework in our world. And how, and if once the world does understand that, then it's going to be much easier to invest on a long-term basis in these projects.
So perhaps we need a charismatic megafauna equivalent for peer research, you know, the panda of science.
Right. I mean, if that could be enough, that'd be perfect. But I think even the panda and the rhinos are not working right now. So
that's true. Maybe yeah. the public has been flooded with images of rhinos enough. There might be more images of rhinos actually out there than there are actual rhinos in the wild, which might be a little bit
concerning.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, actually the issue of conservation. I mean, I'm not surprised that it came up given all of our mutual interests in the field of conservation biology. But you know, in the 80s there was this big debate, and it still continues on today, between American ecologists and American biologists and British ecologists. It was actually with the British Ecological Society, and there was this argument between the two schools that of thought that, you know, the British Ecological Society really believed in science and ecology for the sake of ecology, and that, you know, what it was the ecologist's duty to study and report upon whatever they saw taking place, and they should not be advocates, and also that they should be free to do any kind of research they wanted, in the sense that even if the results of that research might be interpreted in a certain way that would lead to consequences, say for pandas, you know, imagine someone published a paper saying, you know what, maybe pandas aren't as endangered as we originally thought they were, and that led to, you know, a public outcry as to why are we funding panda conservation, and then, you know, 3 years down the line pandas are all extinct. There was this kind of idea amongst the ecologists in Britain that should be the way ecology and science should be done. It should be very hands-off from the rest of the world, and it should just be focused on this pure science for the sake of science. Now, the American ecologists were very much in the other camp, and it's actually the group of ecologists that argued for this are the ones that led to the creation of the Society for Conservation Biology in the 80s. And they argued that it is an ecologist's duty to actually publish and take a position in this broader sphere, and to be also very careful with the kind of work they publish, because these ramifications or the ramifications of some of our research might not be taken by the public in the same way that the scientists might publish it. So to use the panda example, you know, they might say, okay, well, maybe pandas are not as endangered as we once thought they were. You know, recognizing that the media and the public might not understand the nuance behind that research, they might tend to word it differently, or they might respond, or rather they publish an op-ed or some kind of other media form with their original publication to make sure and to clarify that, you know, their findings are just one of a vast swath of research on the topics, and that one paper is not the be-all end-all. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that, yeah, I think conservationists specifically in conservation biology has had this issue from essentially its beginnings as to, you know, should we be doing pure research and funding pure research that might actually lead to these negative consequences? Because I can't imagine too many people, especially those listening to this podcast, would be, you know, totally cool with all of our animals going extinct. But, you know, that's another question for another episode, I suppose. But I mean, what do you guys think in terms of should there be peer research? Should even amongst peer research, should there be these restrictions?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a slippery slope to go down if you start taking research and effectively, I mean, I know you weren't advocating for this, but to me, it sounds like effectively silencing research that doesn't agree with what's for the greatest good of everyone. But I mean, research should be impartial. It should have its own. It shouldn't be manipulated in that way, I don't think. I think that's a really slippery slope to go down, because I mean, that can just kind of grow from there. I mean, who determines what's good research and what's bad research, right?
Absolutely.
And again, as you're saying, Kyle, you're saying it's a slippery slope. It's a situation where we do not want these species to go extinct. But at the same time, our job and our mandate is to provide truth, provide what's happening in our world to the public and to the decision makers. And so saying this in that sense, phrasing it that way, saying that we would only publish or discuss the positive results or the results that we want to publish for the greater good of our charismatic species, as an example, it should not be the way to go. It's like pharmaceutical companies publishing only papers when it is something positive they found, you know, when the medication is working at 97%, whereas when it's not working, they're not publishing it or they won't talk about it. But that is as true as when the medication is working. And that is our mandate as researchers as well. So it's a tough question. It's very philosophical. Do we do it for the results and only to inform people, or do we do it because we have a goal in mind and we want to reach that goal? And again, like that's complicated, because that will affect our funding opportunities. That will affect just your general opinions about situations in the world. And that's where we are not robots. We will fall into conflict of interest sometimes, but as scientists, we need to make sure we leave these conflicts aside and we do the science as it's supposed to be done. Whether it's a positive or a negative result, it should be publishable, and we should be able to know if something is not as endangered as we thought it was. And this should not change our actions upon these things, but just understand that it's not because the panda is not as endangered that we can keep, I don't know, the poaching and whatever is done. We still need to respect and to keep behaving as if that species was endangered to maintain it. But at the same time, truth is a truth and it needs to be shared.
So you really, actually, I'm really happy you brought that up. It touched on, you know, another one of these fundamental mental problems and debates in the sciences, is that that we don't publish our negative results, right? Because we're not publishing these negative results, we already have a bias, right, amongst the way we release science to the public and even within our own communities, you know, even amongst biologists, amongst ecologists, amongst scientists in general, there's already these biases and these censures, you know, taking place. And like you mentioned, Kyle, I mean, the it certainly is a slippery slope to go down, you know, to start saying, you know, this is what we should be talking about, this is what we should not be talking about. And like you mentioned, Charlie Munger, the pharmaceutical company, or the tobacco industry, I believe, is kind of the poster child for that kind of work. You know, they fund this cancer research, but how much of that cancer research is published and how much attention it gets varies on whether or not it supports their own agenda. But knowing, or rather, since we know that there's a bias, I mean, humans in general, we are biased. Should we, as scientists undertaking both peer and applied research, should we be taking control and taking charge of that bias where we can, and actually, you know, instead of letting the media, for example, or the general public control the bias that exists within the dissemination of science, should we be taking that power back to us as scientists? Do we have more of an educated guess, or rather an educated opinion, that as to what should be reported and what should not be? It's kind of like what you were mentioning, Kyle. You know, who's to decide where we draw the line, and should we as scientists be taking that back when we're undertaking peer research or even applied research?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great way of doing it. If it was like, if scientists were the ones determining, well, I mean, in a way we are, right? Because, you know, there's a peer review process and everything. So in a way we are kind of filtering out the information, but I mean, that's not to say like we shouldn't be like being more biased to counteract the media's bias is definitely not the solution. But I think, I don't know. It's certainly, I think things would be a lot better if there wasn't so much media influence on what kind of research gets out to the public.
I have a question now. We talk about these big scientists in the past, like Isaac Newton, Galileo, Einstein, and what was different with them and why are they so famous, besides the great theories they founded or they discovered, is that they were free scientists, and not only free in the sense they did their own research without any funding, in the sense that they were the ones sharing what they would find. You know, they would share it the way they wanted, and it was not as controlled. So essentially, with the world we have right now, it's just much more difficult to get your word across, because the way that science works, if you don't publish, if you don't share it within these, I don't know, 5-10 journals, then no one's going to hear about what you did or what you discovered, and it's not valid. And I think as scientists, as trained scientists, we do earn the right to make these discoveries, whether they're positive or negative, and share them with the world. And so let me know what you think, but in my opinion, the way science works right now, the way it's legislatized with governments, it's much harder to get our point across if it does not go in the same way that we want it to go. With Donald Trump, president of the United States, we can be sure that there's a bit less groundbreaking research about ecology that will pop up, because there is some control happening. And we would, like, the only way really to get our point across would be to almost do the job ourselves, if you know what I mean. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and reining that control in. I'm curious as to whether or not science was truly, truly different in the, you know, in the times of Galileo and Einstein. I mean, we know that the church at that time period exerted, well, not necessarily Einstein, but certainly Galileo and Newton, you know, they exerted a much stronger influence upon what kind of research was, or what information was being disseminated. And we also do know what happened to people that didn't necessarily agree with some of what they were mentioning. Namely, they wound up on a stake. But I don't know if we look back and we think of science or scientists as, and this is what I was kind of mentioning earlier, I touched upon, was, you know, do we look at the past and kind of have this image, this myth that pure science, that fundamental science, and that of this of this kind of golden age of science where ideas were free and everyone was open-minded to any idea out there, you know, whether or not this was actually a reality or just were we living or has it always been, you know, that applied aspect of research being kind of the primary motivator for much of these scientists, but also whether or not these scientists truly were as independent as we feel that they were. I don't know if that made sense there. A little bit too out there, you know, going into the past, but I mean, I'm curious as to what, I don't know, Kyle, do you think that there was ever truly an era of pure unrestricted research?
I'm not sure, but I'd like to say yes. I mean, I'm just thinking of all these guys you're talking about, all these famous scientists, like Darwin, for example. This is probably as pure as it gets, right? So, I mean, you don't really hear stories like this nowadays of people going out and just pursuing research for the sake of pursuing research. There's always some kind of incentive tied into it for how it's going to feed back into society and benefit other people, right? So I think maybe there was more of it, but I'm sure, like, of course there's an applied side to it as well. Maybe we focus more on the pure side because the ideas were so revolutionary.
Do you think there's anything stopping us today from pursuing that pure research? Because I imagine it's certainly cheaper to jump across the world nowadays and take significantly less time than it did, you know, back in the time of Darwin, where only a very, very small portion of people were able to do that. I mean, is there anything really, and actually also it's kind of speaks that double-edged sword of the media in that there's that bias, as you mentioned, Kyle, but there's also, and kind of touching upon what you mentioned, Charlie, there's this, you know, we are, as scientists, we actually can use the media. We can, even if, you know, Nature decides not to publish our article, we can say, hey, we did this really cool research and publish it on Twitter and other forms of social media, and maybe it'll pick up traction through there. So there's more, and, you know, not touching upon all those kind of crazy pay fake journals out there, but that I'm sure you guys also get 1,001 emails about. But I feel like there's a lot of, you know, areas that we can publish research now, and combined with the fact that it's much cheaper and easier to travel around the world because of how connected we are. I mean, for example, like Charlie, if you wanted to, is there anything necessarily stopping you right now from flying out to Mongolia and, you know, coming up with your own project and studying up in the mountains for a week and flying back and publishing that, whether through Nature or on Twitter?
Well, there's nothing physically stopping me to do that. Of course, there are financial restrictions, but a little planning a couple months ahead, and I'm sure I would be able to make it there without any problem. So I totally agree with you in that sense that we do have, the world is much more accessible. Media communication means are much more accessible as well. And that's why I find it very interesting. And to go back quickly on my example of Isaac Newton and whatnot, they are really famous scientists, but how many scientists were there out there? Maybe there were thousands, millions of scientists, but only these ones, these names stuck because they did something different. So that is not to say that maybe the science was the same back in the days, but these names just stuck because they did something different. They had that groundbreaking research that they did on their own. And that's what made it so famous to this day. And also because it was so important discoveries. To go back to your example of me flying to Mongolia, of course, it would be very easy for me to do that right now compared to what it would be like for Charles Darwin to go to the Galapagos Islands as an example. But now the question is, does it happen right now? Do you think we have scientists taking it upon themselves and doing research on their own? Is it something that's still possible without the legislation, without the permits you need to do research? Is this something that's truly possible in our world right now, besides flying and just writing articles? Can we actually do it and enter a national park and evaluate our species and be able to stay there for the required period of time? You think it's the world is as accessible in that sense? Are we allowed to stay in these areas?
Well, were we allowed to stay in those areas in the past as well, or did we just walk on in and take what we want and left?
I don't know, to be honest with you.
Bit of both.
Yeah, I mean, so we are rounding on the hour here. I don't know, is there anything else you guys had in mind in terms of the peer versus applied debate in research and ecology or on the paper in general?
Well, this was an interesting paper for anyone who's thinking about doing research in ecology, that there is a debate and there are some disparities between fundamental and applied research and as well as development research. But at the same time, we do need to include a bit of all of these things in our research to get the funding we want and to understand the broader picture of the work we do nowadays.
Yeah, I think important take home would be that it's important to consider both aspects when you're designing projects. You know, the fundamental part and then the applied part. If you can integrate both of those, then I think you're doing well.